few years ago, a sale was made which is said to have been the most far-reaching and important sale of its kind ever made. The object of the sale was not merchandise, but the freedom of a man who was confined in the Ohio Penitentiary and the development of a prison reform system that promises a sweeping change in the method of dealing with unfortunate men and women who have become entangled in the meshes of the law. Imagination and persuasion. That you may observe just how imagination plays the leading part in salesmanship, I will analyze this sale for you, with due apologies for personal references, which cannot be avoided without destroying much of the value of the illustration. A few years ago, I was invited to speak before the inmates of the Ohio Penitentiary. When I stepped upon the platform, I saw in the audience before me a man whom I had known as a successful businessman more than 10 years previously. That man was Mr. B., whose pardon I later secured, and the story of whose release has been spread upon the front page of practically every newspaper in the United States. Perhaps you will recall it. After I had completed my address, I interviewed Mr. B. and found out they had been sentenced for forgery for a period of 20 years. After he told me his story, I said, "I will have you out of here in less than 60 days. With a forced smile, he replied, "I admire your spirit, but question your judgment. Why, do you know that at least 20 influential men have tried every means at their command to get me released, without success? It can't be done." I suppose it was that last remark, "it can't be done," that challenged me to show him it could be done. I returned to New York City and requested my wife to pack her trunks and get ready for an indefinite stay in the city of Columbus, where the Ohio Penitentiary is located. I had a definite purpose in mind. That purpose was to get Mr. B. out of the Ohio Penitentiary. Not only did I have in mind securing his release, but I intended to do it in such a way that his release would erase from his breast the scarlet letter of convict and at the same time reflect credit upon all who helped him bring about his release. Not once did I doubt that I would bring about his release, for no salesman can make a sale if he doubts that he can do it. My wife and I returned to Columbus and took up permanent headquarters. The next day, I called on the Ohio governor and stated the object of my visit in about these words. "Governor, I have come to ask you to release Mr. B. from the Ohio Penitentiary. I have sound reason for asking his release, and I hope you will give him his freedom at once. But I have come prepared to stay until he is released, no matter how long that may be." During his imprisonment, Mr. B. has inaugurated a system of correspondence instruction in the Ohio Penitentiary, as you of course know. He has influenced 1,729 of the 2,518 prisoners of the Ohio Penitentiary to take up courses of instruction. He has managed to beg sufficient textbooks and lesson materials with which to keep these men at work on their lessons, and has done this without a penny of expense to the state of Ohio. The warden and the chaplain of the penitentiary tell me that he has carefully observed the prison rules. Surely a man who can influence 1,729 prisoners to turn their efforts towards self-betterment cannot be a very bad sort of fellow. I have come to ask you to release Mr. B. because I wish to place him at the head of a prison school that will give the 160,000 inmates of the other penitentiaries of the United States a chance to profit by his influence. I am prepared to assume full responsibility for his conduct after his release. That is my case, but before you give me your answer, I want you to know that I am not unmindful of the fact that your enemies will probably criticize you if you release him. In fact, if you release him, it may cost you many votes if you run for office again. With his fist clenched and his broad jaw set firmly, Governor Vic Donahue of Ohio said, "If that is what you want with Mr. B., I will release him if it costs me 5,000 votes. However, before I sign the pardon, I want you to see the Clemency Board and secure its favorable recommendation. I also want you to secure the favorable recommendation of the warden and the chaplain of the Ohio Penitentiary. You know a governor is amenable to the court of public opinion, and these gentlemen are the representatives of that court." The sale had been made, and the whole transaction had required less than 5 minutes. The next day, I returned to the governor's office, accompanied by the chaplain of the Ohio Penitentiary, and notified the governor that the Clemency Board, the warden, and the chaplain all joined in recommending the release. 3 days later, the pardon was signed, and Mr. B. walked through the big iron gates a free man. I have cited the details to show you that there was nothing difficult about the transaction. The groundwork for the release had all been prepared before I came upon the scene. Mr. B. had done that by his good conduct and the service he had rendered to those 1,729 prisoners. When he created the world's first prison correspondence school system, he created the key that unlocked the prison doors for himself. Why, then, had the others who had asked for his release failed to secure it? They failed because they used no imagination. Perhaps they asked the governor for Mr. B.'s release on the ground that his parents were prominent people, or on the ground that he was a college graduate and not a bad sort of fellow. They failed to supply the governor of Ohio with a sufficient motive to justify him in granting a pardon, for had this not been so, he would undoubtedly have released Mr. B. long before I came upon the scene and asked for his release. Before I went to see the governor, I went over all the facts, and in my imagination, I saw myself in the governor's place and made up my mind what sort of presentation would appeal most strongly to me if I were in reality in his place. When I asked for Mr. B.'s release, I did so in the name of the 160,000 unfortunate men and women inmates of the prisons of the United States who would enjoy the benefits of the correspondence school system that he had created. I said nothing about his prominent parents. I said nothing about my friendship with him during former years. I said nothing about his being a deserving fellow. All these matters might have been used as sound reasons for his release, but they seemed insignificant when compared to the bigger and sounder reason that his release would be of help to 160,000 other people who would feel the influence of his correspondence school system after his release. When the governor of Ohio came to a decision, I doubt not that Mr. B. was of secondary importance as far as his decision was concerned. The governor no doubt saw a possible benefit, not to Mr. B. alone, but to 160,000 other men and women who needed the influence that Mr. B. could supply if released. And that was the magic. It was also salesmanship. In speaking of the incident after it was over, one of those who had worked diligently for more than a year in trying to secure Mr. B.'s freedom asked, "How did you do it?" And I replied, "It was the easiest task I ever performed, because most of the work had been done before I took hold of it. In fact, I didn't do it. Mr. B. did it himself." This man looked at me in bewilderment. He did not see that which I am here trying to make clear, namely, that practically all difficult tasks are easily performed if one approaches them from the right angle. There were two important factors entering Mr. B.'s release. The first was the fact that he had supplied the material for a good case before I took it in charge. And the second was the fact that before I called on the governor of Ohio, I so completely convinced myself that I had the right to ask for Mr. B.'s release that I had no difficulty in presenting my case effectively. Go back to what was stated in the beginning of this lesson on the subject of telepathy and apply it to this case. The governor could tell, long before I had stated my mission, that I knew I had a good case. If my brain did not telegraph this thought to his brain, then the look of self-confidence in my eyes and the positive tone of my voice made obvious my belief in the merits of my case. Again, I apologize for these personal references, with the explanation that I have used them only because the whole of America was familiar with the Mr. B. case that I have described. I disclaim all credit for the small part I played in the case, for I did nothing except use my imagination as an assembly room in which to piece together the factors out of which the sale was made. I did nothing except that which any salesman of imagination could have done. I cannot recall an incident in my entire life in connection with which the soundness of the 17 factors that enter into this course was more clearly manifested than it was in securing the release of Mr. B. It is but another link in a long chain of evidence that proves to my entire satisfaction the power of imagination as a factor in salesmanship. There are endless millions of approaches to every problem, but there is only one best approach. Find this one best approach, and your problem is easily solved. No matter how much merit your goods may have, there are millions of wrong ways in which to offer them. Your imagination will assist you in finding the right way. In your search for the right way in which to offer your merchandise or your services, remember this peculiar trait of mankind. Men will grant favors that you request for the benefit of a third person when they would not grant them if requested for your benefit. Compare this statement with the fact that I asked the governor of Ohio to release Mr. B. not as a favor to me, and not as a favor to Mr. B., but for the benefit of 160,000 unfortunate inmates of the prisons of America. Salesmen of imagination always offer their wares in such terminology that the advantages of those wares to the prospective purchaser are obvious. It is seldom that anyone makes a purchase of merchandise or renders another a favor just to accommodate the salesman. It is a prominent trait of human nature that prompts us all to do that which advances our own interests. This is a cold, indisputable fact, claims of the idealist to the contrary notwithstanding. To be perfectly plain, men are... To understand the truth is to understand how to present your case, whether you're asking for the release of a man from prison or offering for sale some commodity. In your own imagination, plan the presentation of your case so that the strongest and most impelling advantages to the buyer are made plain. This is imagination. A farmer moved to the city, taking with him his well-trained shepherd dog. He soon found that the dog was out of place in the city, so he decided to get rid of him. Taking the dog with him, he went out into the country and rapped on the door of a farmhouse. A man came hobbling to the door on crutches. The man with the dog greeted the man in the house in these words, "You wouldn't care to buy a fine shepherd dog that I wish to get rid of, would you?" The man on crutches replied, "No," and closed the door. The man with the dog called at half a dozen other farmhouses, asking the same question, and received the same answer. He made up his mind that no one wanted the dog and returned to the city. That evening, he was telling of his misfortune to someone with imagination. The man heard how the owner of the dog had tried in vain to get rid of him. "Let me dispose of the dog for you," said the man of imagination. The owner was willing. The next morning, the man of imagination took the dog out into the country and stopped at the first farmhouse at which the owner of the dog had called the day before. The same old man hobbled out on crutches and answered the knock at the door. The man of imagination greeted him in this fashion. "I see you are crippled with rheumatism. What you need is a fine dog to run errands for you. I have a dog here that has been trained to bring home the cows, drive away wild animals, herd the sheep, and perform other useful services. You may have this dog for $100. "All right," said the crippled man. "I'll take him." That, too, was imagination. Most anyone would like to own a dog that would herd sheep and bring home the cows and perform other useful services. The dog was the same one that the crippled buyer had refused the day before, but the man who sold the dog was not the man who tried to get rid of him. If you use your imagination, you will know that no one wants anything that someone else is trying to get rid of. Remember what was said about the law of attraction, through the operation of which like attracts like. If you look and act the part of a failure, you will attract nothing but failures. Whatever your life work may be, it calls for the use of imagination. Niagara Falls was nothing but a great mass of roaring water until a man of imagination harnessed it and converted the wasted energy into electric current that now turns the wheels of industry. Before this man of imagination came along, millions of people had seen and heard those roaring falls, but lacked the imagination to harness them. The first Rotary Club of the world was born in the fertile imagination of Paul Harris of Chicago, who saw in this child of his brain an effective means of cultivating prospective clients and the extension of his law practice, since the ethics of the legal profession forbid commercial advertising. Paul Harris's imagination found a way to extend his law practice without advertising in the usual way. If the winds of fortune are temporarily blowing against you, remember that you can harness them and make them carry you toward your definite purpose through the use of your imagination. A kite rises against the wind, not with it. Dr. Frank Crane was a struggling third-rate preacher until the starvation wages of the clergy forced him to use his imagination. Now he earns upward of $100,000 a year for an hour's work a day writing essays. Woolworth was a poorly paid clerk in a retail store. Poorly paid, perhaps, because he had not yet found out that he had imagination. Before he died, he built the tallest office building in the world and girdled the United States with 5- and 10-cent stores through the use of his imagination. You will observe, by analyzing these illustrations, that a close study of human nature played an important part in the achievements mentioned. To make profitable use of your imagination, you must make it give you a keen insight into the motives that cause people to do or refrain from doing a given act. If your imagination leads you to understand how quickly people grant your requests, when those requests appeal to their self-interest, you can have practically anything you go. Commentary from the editors. The story of David Lloyd provides not only an example of an imaginative use of appealing to someone's self-interest, but it also speaks to the value of going the extra mile. David Lloyd grew up in a small Alabama town, an African-American in a place where black people owned few businesses. He had only a high school education. On a trip to San Diego, California, for the first time he saw the ocean and a marina full of boats. Lloyd was fascinated. He got a job working for a company that repaired yachts. His excitement about his work and his dedication to doing it well quickly won him attention, and soon he was overwhelmed with offers of freelance work on some of San Diego's finest yachts. Lloyd saw an opportunity. One handsome yacht in the marina was in particular need of work. Lloyd approached the owner and offered to make all repairs for the cost of the materials if the owner would allow him to take before and after photographs to show prospective clients. Lloyd probably could have got himself hired to fix the yacht anyway, but he went the extra mile and appealed to the owner's self-interest by offering to do the work for free. Naturally, the owner accepted, and Lloyd got his photos, but even more important, he had so impressed the yacht owner that the man began referring more work to Lloyd, eventually more than 50 clients. Even with his business so brisk that he could barely keep up, Lloyd continued to teach himself the skills he needed. He read books on everything from accounting fundamentals to varnishing. He received certification that allowed him to bid on the biggest and most lucrative contracts for aircraft carriers and cruise ships. From there, Lloyd built his business into one of the largest and most successful shipbuilding and repair companies in the nation, working with clients like General Dynamics, Exxon, and the U.S. Navy. He was always willing to work harder, using his imagination to put his initiative and leadership on display. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text, I saw my wife make a very clever sale to our baby not long ago. The baby was pounding the top of our mahogany library table with a spoon. When my wife reached for the spoon, the baby refused to give it up. But being a woman of imagination, she offered the baby a nice stick of red candy. He dropped the spoon immediately and centered his attention on the more desirable object. That was imagination. It was also salesmanship. She won her point without using force. There is one form of imagination against which I would caution you. It is the brand that prompts some people to imagine that they can get something for nothing, or that they can force themselves ahead in the world without observing the rights of others. There are more than 160,000 prisoners in the penal institutions of the United States, practically every one of whom is in prison because he imagined he could get something for nothing. There is a man in the Ohio Penitentiary who has served more than 35 years for forgery, and the largest amount he ever got from his misapplication of imagination was $12. There are a few people who direct their imaginations in the vain attempt to work out a way to show what happens when an immovable body comes in contact with an irresistible force, but these types belong in the psychopathic hospitals. There is also another form of misapplied imagination, namely, that of the young boy or girl who knows more about life than his or her dad. But this form is subject to modification with time. My own boys have taught me many things that my dad tried in vain to teach me when I was their age. Time and imagination, which is often but the product of time, teach us many things, but nothing of more importance than this. All of us are much alike in many ways. If you would like to know what your customer is thinking, Mr. Salesman, study yourself and find out what you would be thinking if you were in your customer's place. Study yourself. Find out what are the motives which actuate you in the performance of certain deeds and cause you to refrain from performing other deeds, and you will have gone far toward perfecting yourself in the accurate use of imagination. The detective's biggest asset is imagination. The first question he asks when called in to solve a crime is, "What was the motive?" If he can find out the motive, he can usually find the perpetrator of a crime. A man who had lost a horse posted a reward of $5 for its return. Several days later, a boy who was supposed to have been weak-minded came leading the horse home and claimed the reward. The owner was curious to know how the boy found the horse. "How did you ever think where to look for the horse?" he asked, and the boy replied, "Well, I just thought where I would have gone if I'd been a horse, and went there, and he had." Not so bad for a weak-minded fellow. Some who are not accused of being weak-minded go all the way through life without displaying as much evidence of imagination as did this boy. If you want to know what the other person will do, use your imagination. Put yourself in the place of the other and find out what you would have done. That's imagination. Every person should be somewhat of a dreamer. Every business needs a dreamer. Every industry and every profession needs him. But the dreamer must be also a doer, or else he must form an alliance with someone who can and does translate dreams into reality. Imagination and action. The greatest nation upon the face of this earth was conceived, born, and nurtured through the early days of its childhood as the result of imagination in the minds of people who combine dreams with action. Your mind is capable of creating many new and useful combinations of old ideas, but the most important thing it can create is a definite chief aim that will give you that which you most desire. Your definite chief aim can be speedily translated into reality after you have fashioned it in the cradle of your imagination. If you have faithfully followed the instructions set down for your guidance in Lesson 2 in Volume 1 of The Law of Success, you are now well on the road toward success because you know what it is that you want and you have a plan for getting that which you want. The battle for the achievement of success is half won when one knows definitely what is wanted. The battle is all over except the shouting when one knows what is wanted and has made up his mind to get it, whatever the price may be. The selection of a definite chief aim calls for the use of both imagination and decision. The power of decision grows with use. Prompt decision and forcing the imagination to create a definite chief aim renders more powerful the capacity to reach decisions in other matters. Adversities and temporary defeat are generally blessings in disguise, for the reason that they force one to use both imagination and decision. This is why all of us usually make a better fight when our backs are to the wall and we know there is no retreat. We then reach the decision to fight instead of running. Editor's Commentary. Ben Nighthorse Campbell got used to people saying no, and he found imaginative ways around those negative answers. Campbell had a tough childhood, in and out of foster homes. He dropped out of high school, wound up in the Air Force, worked his way through college, and then moved to Japan to study judo. He won a gold medal in judo in the 1963 Pan Am Games and was captain of the U.S. Olympic team a year later in Tokyo. He returned to the United States that year. In Japan, he had learned a jewelry-making technique that could be applied to traditional Native American arts. Though Campbell's father had been reluctant to acknowledge his roots, he had passed along the craft of jewelry-making to his son. Ben began executing his own designs in the new technique and displaying them at shows. When his jewelry won popular success, Campbell began exploring further his Native American roots. His commitment to his heritage led him into politics. He was drafted in 1982 as a candidate for the Colorado State House of Representatives, and 4 years later, he was the only Native American elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. In 1994, he became only the second Native American to be elected to the U.S. Senate. Campbell still designs his jewelry and is one of the most popular artists in the country. Though the circumstances of his life presented him with a series of situations in which Campbell was told to ignore or forget his aspirations, his imagination allowed him to see possibility where others saw only limitation. John H. Johnson is another who became a success because he wouldn't take no for an answer. In 1939, Johnson was editor of The Guardian, the in-house publication of Supreme Liberty, the largest life insurance firm in America targeted to African Americans. In the publication, positive news about blacks were reprinted for the edification of company employees. Johnson came to see that what The Guardian did for the company's employees was something that ought to be done for African Americans everywhere. But the respected editor of The Crisis, the NAACP's magazine, told him, "Save your money, young man. Save your energy, save yourself a lot of disappointment." A banker he approached for startup capital told him, "Boy, we don't make loans to colored people." But Johnson's determination convinced executives at Supreme Liberty to give him their mailing list of 20,000 names. By November 1942, the first issue of Negro Digest was on newsstands, featuring reprints of articles by the likes of Carl Sandburg and the director of the NAACP. Within a year, Negro Digest was including original articles by prominent people of all colors, including First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. The success of Negro Digest gave Johnson the money to pursue even bigger projects, including the launch in 1945 of Ebony. He He knew that getting one major advertiser would help keep his company afloat. He targeted Zenith Corporation, also based in Chicago, and went after it with consummate imagination. Zenith's chairman, Eugene McDonald, was famous for having gone to the North Pole. Johnson decided to appeal to McDonald's interest by running a feature on Matthew Henson, a black man who had made it to the North Pole ahead of the famed Robert Perry. When Johnson arrived at McDonald's office, he saw on the wall a pair of snowshoes that Henson had given to the executive. McDonald was easily persuaded that Ebony was a good place to advertise. For the next 20 years, Johnson continued his campaign to interest big companies in the black consumer. His publishing operations were successful, and by the mid-1960s, Johnson was a member of the board of companies like Zenith and 20th Century Fox. In 1982, he was the first black person to appear on the Forbes 400 list of wealthiest Americans. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. The late Dr. Harper, who was formerly president of the University of Chicago, was one of the most efficient college presidents of his time. He had a penchant for raising funds in large amounts. It was he who induced John D. Rockefeller to contribute millions of dollars to the support of the University of Chicago. It may be helpful to the student of this philosophy to study Dr. Harper's technique because he was a leader of the highest order. Moreover, I have his own word for it that his leadership was never a matter of chance or accident, but always the result of carefully planned procedure. The following incident will serve to show just how Dr. Harper made use of imagination in raising money in large sums. Dr. Harper needed an extra $1 million for the construction of a new building. Taking inventory of the wealthy men of Chicago to whom he might turn for this large sum, he decided upon two, each of whom was a millionaire, and both were bitter enemies. One of these was, at that time, the head of the Chicago Street Railway System. Choosing the noon hour, when the office force and this man's secretary in particular would be apt to be out at lunch, Dr. Harper nonchalantly strolled into the office and, finding no one on guard at the outer door, walked into the office of his intended victim, whom he surprised by his appearance unannounced. "My name is Harper," said the doctor, "and I am president of the University of Chicago. Pardon my intrusion, but I found no one in the outer office, so I took the liberty of walking on in. I have thought of you and your street railway system many, many times. You have built up a wonderful system, and I understand that you have made lots of money for your efforts. I never think of you, however, without it occurring to me that one of these days you will be passing out into the great unknown, and after you are gone there will be nothing left as a monument to your name, because others will take over your money, and money has a way of losing its identity very quickly, as soon as it changes hands. I have often thought of offering you the opportunity to perpetuate your name by permitting you to build a new hall out on the university grounds and naming it after you. I would have offered you this opportunity long ago had it not been for the fact that one of the members of our board wishes the honor to go to..." He then gave the name of the man's rival. "Personally, however, I have always favored you and I still favor you, and if I have your permission to do so, I'm going to try to swing the opposition over to you. I have not come to ask for any decision today, however, as I was just passing and thought it was a good time to drop in and meet you. Think the matter over, and if you wish to talk to me about it again, telephone me at your leisure. Good day, sir. I am happy to have had this opportunity to meet you." With this, he bowed himself out without giving the head of the streetcar company a chance to say either yes or no. In fact, the streetcar man had very little chance to do any talking. Dr. Harper did the talking. That was as he planned it to be. He went into the office merely to plant the seed, believing that it would germinate and spring into life. And his belief was not without foundation. He had hardly returned to his office at the university when the telephone rang. It was the streetcar man. He asked for an appointment with Dr. Harper, and the two met in Dr. Harper's office the next morning, and the check for $1 million was in Dr. Harper's hands an hour later. Despite the fact that Dr. Harper was a small, rather insignificant-looking man, it was said of him that he had a way about him that enabled him to get everything he went after. And as to this way that he was reputed to have had, what was it? It was nothing more nor less than his understanding of the power of imagination. Suppose he had gone to the office of the streetcar head and asked for an appointment. Sufficient time would have elapsed between the time he called and the time when he would have actually seen this man to have enabled the latter to anticipate the reason for his call, and also to formulate a good, logical excuse for saying no. Suppose, again, he had opened his interview with the streetcar man something like this. "The university is badly in need of funds, and I have come to you to ask your help. You have made lots of money, and you owe something to the community in which you have made it," which perhaps was true. "If you will give us $1 million, we will place your name on a new hall that we wish to build." What might have been the result? In the first place, there would have been no motive suggested that was sufficiently appealing to sway the mind of the streetcar man. While it may have been true that he owed something to the community from which he had made a fortune, he probably would not have admitted that fact. In the second place, he would have enjoyed the position of being on the offensive instead of the defensive side of the proposal. But Dr. Harper, shrewd in the use of imagination as he was, provided for just such contingencies by the way he stated his case. First, he placed the streetcar man on the defensive by informing him that it was not certain that he, Dr. Harper, could get the permission of his board to accept the money and name the hall after the streetcar man. In the second place, he intensified the desire of the streetcar man to have his name on that building because of the thought that his enemy and competitor might get the honor if it got away from him. Moreover, and this was no accident either, Dr. Harper had made a powerful appeal to one of the most common of all human weaknesses by showing this streetcar man how to perpetuate his own name. All of which required a practical application of the law of imagination. Dr. Harper was a master salesman. When he asked for money, he always paved the way for success by planting in the mind of the person of whom he asked it a good sound reason why the money should be given, a reason which emphasized some advantage accruing to the man as a result of the gift. Often, this would take on the form of a business advantage. Again, it would take on the nature of an appeal to that part of a man's nature which prompts him to wish to perpetuate his name so it will live after him. But, always, the request for money was carried out according to a plan that had been carefully thought out, embellished, and smoothed down with the use of imagination. From the editors. When the editors of this revised and updated edition of The Principles of Personal Power set about the task of reviewing the material in the original edition, it was concluded that there were certain instances where the text would benefit from the inclusion of contemporary stories. However, once the task was actually begun, it became clear that very often Napoleon Hill's stories illustrated certain concepts so well that replacing those would have resulted in little more than mentioning names that are more familiar to the modern listener, while adding little of consequence to the point being made. It was with that in mind that the editors decided to include the following section from the original text, in which Hill offers ideas that he suggests the imaginative person could take and develop into products or businesses. As you might guess, every one of the concepts he offered was taken up by someone and turned into a reality. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. While the law of success philosophy was in the embryonic stage, long before it had been organized into a systematic course of instruction and reduced to textbooks, I was lecturing on this philosophy in a small town in Illinois. One of the members of the audience was a young life insurance salesman. After hearing what was said on the subject of imagination, he began to apply what he had heard to his own problem of selling life insurance. Something was said during the lecture about the value of allied effort, through which people may enjoy greater success by cooperative effort through a working arrangement under which each boosts the interests of the other. Taking this suggestion as his cue, the young man in question immediately formulated a plan whereby he gained the cooperation of a group of businessmen who were in no way connected with the insurance business. Going to the leading grocer in his town, he made arrangements with that grocer to give a $1,000 insurance policy to every customer purchasing no less than $50 worth of groceries each month. He then made it a part of his business to inform people of this arrangement and brought in many new customers. The groceryman had a large, neatly lettered card placed in his store, informing his customers of this offer of free insurance, thus helping himself by offering all his customers an inducement to do all their trading in the grocery line with him. This young insurance man then went to the leading gas station and made arrangements with the owner to insure all customers who purchased all their gasoline, oil, and other motor supplies from him. Next, he went to the leading restaurant in the town and made a similar arrangement with the owner. Incidentally, this alliance proved to be quite profitable to the restaurateur, who promptly began an advertising campaign in which it was stated that the food was so pure, wholesome, and good that all who ate there regularly would be apt to live much longer. Therefore, he would insure the life of each regular customer for $1,000. The life insurance salesman then made arrangements with a local builder and real estate man to insure the life of each person buying property from him for an amount sufficient to pay off the balance due on the property in case the purchaser died before payments were completed. The young man in question is now the general agent for one of the largest life insurance companies in the United States, with headquarters in one of the largest cities in Ohio. The turning point in his life came when he discovered how he might make practical use of the law of imagination. There is no patent on his plan. It may be duplicated over and over again by other life insurance sellers who know the value of imagination. Just now, if I were engaged in selling life insurance, I think I should make use of this plan by allying myself with a group of automobile distributors in each of several cities, thus enabling them to sell more automobiles, and at the same time providing for the sale of a large amount of life insurance through their efforts. Financial success is not difficult to achieve after one learns how to make practical use of creative imagination. Someone with sufficient initiative and leadership and the necessary imagination will duplicate the fortunes being made each year by the owners of 5- and 10-cent stores by developing a system of marketing the same sort of goods now sold in these stores with the aid of vending machines. This will save a fortune in clerk hire, insure against theft, and cut down the overhead of store operation in many other ways. Such a system can be conducted just as successfully as food can be dispensed with the aid of automatic vending machines. The seed of the idea has here been sown. It is yours for the taking. Someone with an inventive turn of the mind is going to make a fortune and at the same time save thousands of lives each year by perfecting an automatic railroad crossing control that will reduce the number of automobile accidents on crossings. Imagination plus some mechanical skill will give the motorist this much-needed safeguard and make the man who perfects the system all the money he needs and much more besides. Some inventor who understands the value of imagination and has a working knowledge of the radio principle may make a fortune by perfecting a burglar alarm system that will signal police headquarters and at the same time switch on lights and ring a gong in the place about to be burglarized, with the aid of apparatus similar to that now used for broadcast. Any farmer with enough imagination to create a plan, plus the use of a list of all automobile licenses issued in his state, may easily work up a clientele of motorists who will come to his farm and purchase all the vegetables he can produce and all the chickens he can raise, thus saving him the expense of hauling his products to the city. By contracting with each motorist for the season, the farmer may accurately estimate the amount of produce he should provide. The advantage to the motorist, accruing under the arrangement, is that he will be sure of direct from the farm produce, at less cost than he could purchase it from local dealers. The roadside gasoline filling station owner can make effective use of imagination by placing a lunch stand near his filling station and then doing some attractive advertising along the road in each direction, calling attention to his barbecue, homemade sandwiches, or whatever else he may wish to specialize in. The lunch stand will cause the motorist to stop, and many of them will purchase gasoline before starting on their way again. These are simple suggestions involving no particular amount of complication in connection with their use, yet it is just such uses of imagination that bring financial success. The Piggly Wiggly self-help store plan, which made millions of dollars for its originator, was a very simple idea which anyone could have adopted, yet considerable imagination was required to put the idea to work in a practical sort of way. The more simple and easily adapted to a need an idea is, the greater its value, as no one is looking for ideas which are involved with great detail or in any manner complex. Editor's Commentary. The billions of McDonald's hamburgers sold, the invention of whiteout by a secretary, and the success of Mrs. Fields cookies are stories that have been cited so often as modern examples of a simple idea transformed by imagination that they may have begun to lose some of their power to inspire. If that is so, the story of Josie Notori's simple idea should once again ignite your imagination. Raised in the Philippines, Josie Notori came to the United States to study economics and had a successful career as an investment banker. But, she recalls, I was bored. It all came too easy. She and her husband were mulling over starting their own business, considering items they could import from the Philippines, when a friend sent her some children's clothes with elaborate embroidery. Notori took one look at the clothes and was inspired. The look might not work for kids, but she knew it would be dynamite on women's lingerie. She began creating her own designs and soon had orders from major department stores like Saks and Bloomingdale's. From the beginning, Notori told an interviewer, I wasn't consciously trying to challenge the established ideas of lingerie. I simply followed my instincts. I had no preconceived ideas and asked questions that forced buyers to reconsider what a garment should look like. I naturally asked questions like, why can't a nightgown look like an evening gown? Or, who says you can't wear these slippers with that dress? Today, her company does $40 million worth of business annually and sells lingerie across America and in Canada, Italy, Japan, and France. Notori's imagination continues to be the fuel that drives her business forward. She says, even when I'm shopping in a flea market, I'm searching for inspiration. Now back to Napoleon Hill's original text. Imagination and salesmanship. Imagination is the most important factor entering into the art of selling. The master salesman is always one who makes systematic use of imagination. The outstanding merchant relies upon imagination for the ideas that make his business excel. Once again, the editor's comment. During the first quarter of the 20th century, when Napoleon Hill was developing the law of success, business in America was booming. But, in many ways, how people conducted their day-to-day business affairs was still quite traditional. Most merchants had yet to embrace what was to become one of the defining hallmarks of American business, the concept of business as a service industry. In the following, Napoleon Hill addresses the issue of imaginative salesmanship and customer service, and to make his point, he uses everyday examples drawn from his personal experience. Today, Hill's suggestions may seem somewhat quaint compared with our drive-through shopping center, infomercial, e-commerce way of life, but as with the previous section in which Hill gave away ideas, much of what is common business practice today is so because of what Napoleon Hill wrote in the original edition of this book. And now, continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. Imagination may be used effectively in the sale of even the smallest articles of merchandise, such as shirts or ties. I walked into one of the best-known haberdasheries in the city of Philadelphia to purchase some shirts and ties. I picked up two or three ties from the counter, examined them briefly, then laid down all but one light blue that somewhat appealed to me. Finally, I laid this one down also, and began to look through the remainder of the assortment. The young man behind the counter then had a happy idea. Picking up a gaudy-looking yellow tie, he wound it around his fingers to show how it would look when tied, and asked, "Isn't this a beauty?" Now, I hate yellow ties, and the salesman made no particular hit with me by suggesting that a gaudy yellow tie is pretty. If I had been in that salesman's place, I would have picked up the blue tie, for which I had shown a decided preference, and would have wound it around my fingers so as to bring out its appearance after being tied. I would have known what my customer wanted by watching the kinds of ties that he picked up and examined. If given the opportunity, any customer will give the alert salesman a clue as to the particular merchandise that should be stressed in an effort to make a sale. I then moved over to the shirt counter. Here I was met by an elderly gentleman who asked, "Is there something I can do for you today?" Well, I thought to myself, if he ever did anything for me, it would have to be today, as I might never come back to that particular store again. I told him I wanted to look at shirts and describe the style and color of the shirt I wanted. The old gentleman replied, "I am sorry, sir, but they are not wearing that style this season, so we are not showing it." I said I knew they were not wearing the style for which I had asked, and for that very reason, among others, I was going to wear it, providing I could find it in stock. If I were selling goods, I might think what I pleased about a customer's taste, but I surely would not be so lacking in diplomacy as to tell the customer that I thought he didn't know his business. Rather, I would tactfully show him what I believed to be more appropriate merchandise, if what he wanted was not in stock. The old gentleman finally pulled down some shirt boxes and began laying out shirts that were not even similar to the shirt for which I had asked. I told him that none of these suited, and as I started to walk out, he asked if I would like to look at some nice suspenders. It is proper for a salesman to try to interest a customer in wares for which he makes no inquiry, but judgment should be used and care taken to offer something which the salesman has reason to believe the customer may want. I walked out of the store without having bought either shirts or ties, and feeling somewhat resentful because I had been so grossly misjudged as to my taste for colors and styles. A little further down the street, I went into a small, one-man shop which had shirts and ties on display in the window. Here I was handled differently. The salesperson asked no unnecessary or stereotyped questions. He took one glance at me as I entered the door, sized me up quite accurately, and greeted me with a very pleasant, "Good morning, sir." He then inquired, "Which shall I show you first, shirts or ties?" I said I would look at the shirts first. He glanced at the style of shirt I was wearing, asked my size, and began laying out shirts of the very type and color for which I was searching, without my saying another word. He laid out 6 different styles and watched to see which I would pick up first. I looked at each shirt, in turn, and laid them all back on the counter, but the salesman observed that I examined one of the shirts a little more closely than the others, and that I held it a little longer. No sooner had I laid this shirt down than the salesman picked it up and began to explain how it was made. And then he went to the tie counter and came back with 3 very beautiful blue ties, tied each, and held it in front of the shirt, calling attention to the perfect harmony between the colors of the ties and the shirt. Before I had been in the store 5 minutes, I had purchased 3 shirts and 3 ties, and was on my way with the package under my arm, feeling that here was a store to which I would return. I learned afterwards that the merchant who owns the little shop where I made these purchases pays a monthly rental of $500 for the small store and makes a handsome income from the sale of nothing but shirts, ties, and collars. He would have to go out of business with the fixed charge of $500 a month for rent if it were not for his knowledge of human nature, which enables him to make a very high percentage of sales to all who come into this store. I was once walking down Michigan Boulevard in Chicago when my eye was attracted to a beautiful gray suit in the window of a men's store. I had no notion of buying the suit, but I was curious to know the price, so I opened the door and, without entering, merely pushed my head inside and asked the first person I saw how much the suit in the window was. Then followed one of the cleverest bits of sales maneuvering I have ever observed. The salesman knew he could not sell me the suit unless I came into the store, so he said, "Will you not step inside, sir, while I find out the price of the suit?" Of course, he knew the price all the time, but that was his way of disarming me of the thought that he intended to try to sell me the suit. In less than 2 minutes, I found myself standing in front of a case with my coat off, getting ready to try on a coat like the one I had observed in the window. After I was in the coat, which happened to fit almost perfectly, which was no accident thanks to the accurate eyes of an observing salesman, my attention was called to the nice, smooth touch of the material. I rubbed my hand up and down the arm of the coat, as I had seen the salesman do while describing the material, and sure enough, it was a very fine piece of material. By this time, I had again asked the price, and when I was told that the suit was only $50, I was agreeably surprised, because I had come to believe that it might have been priced much higher. However, when I first saw the suit in the window, my guess was that it was priced at about $35, and I doubt that I would have paid that much for it had I not fallen into the hands of a man who knew how to show the suit to best advantage. If the first coat tried on me had been about 2 sizes too large or a size too small, I doubt that any sale would have been made. I bought that suit on the impulse of the moment. A single slip on the part of the salesman would have lost him the sale of that suit. If he had replied $50 when I first asked the price, I would have said thank you and gone my way without looking at the suit. Later in the season, I purchased 2 more suits from this same salesman, and if I now lived in Chicago, the chances are that I would still buy other suits from him because he always showed me suits that were in keeping with my personality. The Marshall Field store in Chicago gets more for merchandise than any other store of its kind in the country. Moreover, people knowingly pay more at this store and feel better satisfied than if they bought the merchandise at another store for less money. Why is this? Well, there are many reasons, among them the fact that anything purchased at the Field store which is not entirely satisfactory may be returned and the purchase price will be refunded. A guarantee goes with every article sold in the Field store. Another reason why people will pay more at the Field store is the fact that the merchandise is displayed and shown to better advantage than it is at most other stores. The Field's window displays are truly works of art. The same is true of the goods displayed in the store. There is a harmony and proper grouping of merchandise throughout the Field's establishment, and this creates an atmosphere that is more, much more, than merely an imaginary one. Still, another reason why the Field store can get more for merchandise than most other merchants is due to the careful selection and supervision of salespeople. One would seldom find a person employed in the field store whom one would not be willing to accept as a neighbor. Merchandise purchased in the field store is packed and wrapped more artistically than is common in other stores, which is still another reason why people go out of their way and pay higher prices to trade there. While we are on the subject of artistic wrapping of merchandise, I wish to relate the experience of a friend of mine which shows how imagination may be used even in wrapping merchandise. This friend had a very fine silver cigarette case that he carried for years and of which he was very proud because it was a gift from his wife. Constant usage had banged the case up rather badly, and he decided to take it to Caldwell the jeweler in Philadelphia to be repaired. He left the case and asked them to send it to his office when it was ready. About 2 weeks later, a splendid-looking new livery wagon with the Caldwell name on it drew up in front of his office, and a nice-looking young man in a neat uniform stepped out with a package that was artistically wrapped and tied with a ribbon. His secretary and other workers in his office gathered around his desk to watch him open up his present. He cut the ribbon and removed the outer covering. Under this was a covering of tissue paper, fastened with beautiful gold seals bearing the Caldwell initials and trademark. This paper was removed, and behold, a most beautiful plush-lined box met his eyes. The box was opened, and after removing the tissue paper packing, there was the cigarette case he had left to be repaired. But it did not look like the same case, thanks to the imagination of the Caldwell manager. Every dent had been carefully straightened out, the hinges had been trued, and the case had been polished and cleaned so it shone as it did when it was first purchased. And the bill? Oh, it was plenty, and yet the price charged for the repair did not seem too high. As a matter of fact, everything that entered into the transaction, from the packing of the case with the fine tissue paper and gold seals, to the delivery of the package, was based upon carefully calculated psychology, which laid the foundation for a high price for the repair. To me, there was a great lesson in the cigarette case incident. The goods you are selling may actually be worth all you're asking for them, but if you do not carefully study the subjects of display and packaging, you may be accused of overcharging your customers.